Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
The Kakadu plum is an Australian native superfood containing 100 times more vitamin C than oranges. So why have you never heard of it? PR. No one's drinking a Kakadu smoothie? I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward, inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. At Navy Federal, it's been the mission to help the military community for over 90 years. And not just help them, but do everything to make sure they not only grow, but flourish. That's why Navy Federal Credit Union has all kinds of great savings and investment options, like share certificates with sky-high rates. So don't hesitate. Start growing your finances today with a variety of savings and investment options. Navy Federal Credit Union. Our members are the mission. Savings products insured by NCUA. Investment products are not insured, not obligations of Navy Federal and may lose value.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick. And Robert, you're a guy who practices meditation sometimes, right?
Well, I practice yoga, which entails a certain amount of meditation. Mm-hmm. I have dabbled in meditation, but I do not currently have a rigorous meditative practice in place in my life.
When you've dabbled, which of the schools of meditation did you try?
Ooh, you know, it was one of these where I just kind of ran up to the buffet of meditation.
Okay.
And tried what was, which steamer tray had been most recently filled and was available. So
A little of everything.
Yeah, a little of everything. Because I've tried some closed eye meditation, some open eye meditation.
Mm-hmm.
Some
Montreuroni and cheese.
Yeah, I mean, I've tried stuff that's more on the secular side and stuff that has more of a spiritual connotation to it. And it's one of those things where I feel like the first time you try it, especially if someone has convinced you that you need to try meditation or you need to try – like it's the same thing with yoga. When someone tells you you need to try this out, there's a strong chance you are not going to really get it the first time.
Mm-hmm.
That you might even dislike it the first time. But when you have time to reflect on what you experienced and then time to try it again kind of at your own pace – then you can begin to see the value in it.
You know, something I've noticed in recent years about the role of yoga and meditation in Western culture is that it has gone from something that's widely considered a kind of, esoteric practice to something that is almost kind of a, I don't know what you'd call it, like a, sometimes it seems weird to meet people who don't do yoga. I don't do yoga,
mm-hmm.
But it seems like everybody I know does yoga at least a little bit or talks about the benefits of meditation. And I wonder if this is just something that changed, I don't know, when I moved to a bigger city, when I moved to Atlanta, I started noticing a lot more people were into meditation and yoga. But I don't know. Have you noticed this similar trend in the past 5 years or so?
Yeah, well, I mean, part of it is urban centers are going to have more opportunities for this sort of thing. But there has been this steady influx of meditative, yogic, just kind of Eastern and New Age ideas in general.
But it feels like these ideas have become mainstream in Western culture fairly recently. Like they, you know, they were there as an esoteric practice mm-hmm. in Western culture for some number of decades, maybe since the middle, late 20th century. And then, and now they're just fully mainstream. You see yoga studios everywhere. There are meditation apps that everybody's talking about. They've all got mm-hmm. on their phones. Biz bros are trying out meditation. I know you've seen this trend too, right? Yeah. All the biz bro manager types are like, yeah, I use meditation to maximize my potential.
You might not remember this, but we had a yoga teacher come to How Stuff Works in recent years, and he did a yoga class for the company, of which I was the only person who attended. But this was years ago. You might not – I don't know if you were even
– I don't think yet. I was aware of this.
But he had a full list of his offerings, and it included like yoga for golf players, yoga for CEOs, that sort of thing, you know?
Yoga for how to fire people.
I guess, yeah, how to detach and all. It is interesting because on one hand, it's easy to look at it and say, well, you're taking something that maybe has more cultural value or more religious or spiritual value, and mm-hmm. then you're sort of boiling it down, or you're stripping it apart and then selling those parts to people.
Well, yeah. I mean, and whether you take a spiritual or religious or a secular view of meditation, these are profound, meaningful cultural practices that mm-hmm. go back for thousands of years.
Yeah. I mean, there are certainly cases, especially with yoga, where we're not always aware of how recently they've been changed by Western hands and Western minds. But
yeah. I guess I was thinking specifically of meditation.
Yeah. Well, I keep coming back to this example when it comes to things like this. So years ago, I was at like a dinner party or something, and I got to talking about I think I was talking about Buddhism or something with someone, and Alan Watts came up. Mm-hmm. You're familiar with Alan Watts?
A little bit.
Yeah. So the other individual said, well, you know, Alan Watts, he's kind of the Walmart of Buddhism, isn't he? and I think she kind of meant it as a put down of Alan Watts. And sometimes I think back to that. And if you look at it with the idea that Buddhism in this case has a central truth to it, a truth that should be shared with the world and or even, you know, wants to be shared with the world, then don't you want it in Walmart? Like you need there to be a Walmart of Buddhism. You need there to be a Walmart of yoga and meditation if you would all believe in the values of these things.
Yeah. So that's sort of the question I was wondering about. Like if you are somebody who participates in this deep, long-rooted, profound cultural tradition of meditation, say you're a monk or mm-hmm. something who does meditation as part of your spiritual practice, are you offended by yoga for golf? Are you offended by, you know, the meditation app that'll help you be a better business manager? Or do you just say, yeah, that's great. More people are taking it up. More people are seeing the benefits and it's going to more of the world.
Yeah. I guess it's one of those things where the answer is going to vary from person to person and tradition to tradition. But, obviously we'd love to hear back from listeners on that, because I know we have a number of listeners who are involved in various, yoga or meditation practices. So when we're talking about meditative practices and meditation here, meditative practices date back at least as far as the second millennium BCE, and this goes back to the Vedic traditions in India. Mm-hmm. And since that time, countless models have spread throughout human culture, weaving their way through Hindu, Buddhist, Taoist, Jewish, Christian, and Islamic traditions. Secular approaches range from elementary school mindfulness instruction to meditation apps, which you mentioned already, for the modern tech-savvy human. Mm-hmm. And styles of meditation also range from stationary to walking, closed eye to open eye, seated to floating.
Yeah. And there are these major schools of meditation you've probably heard about, such mm-hmm. as like the mindfulness meditation or the transcendental meditation or compassion meditation.
Right. And then, of course, there are different schools, transcendental meditation being a major one.
Yeah. That's the one that goes to the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, right?
Yes, correct. Now, I think it's worth noting, though, that at the center of all of these practices, essentially, is you have awareness. One of, if not the key attributes of human consciousness. We come back to that again and again on the show.
So meditation, you could maybe think of as first person experiments in attention, something like that.
Yeah, like I was thinking about it recently. Like, it seems like it's nothing short of the deliberate manipulation of the human experience itself. I am changing my awareness, or I'm refocusing my awareness, and in doing so, I'm kind of reshaping my world. I'm kind of reshaping my experience of reality, at least in the short term.
It's weird to think about how much of our lives we go through without intentionally controlling what we're paying attention to.
Yeah.
We just pay attention to whatever it occurs to us in the moment to pay attention to, rather than making a deliberate effort to concentrate our awareness in one way or another.
Yeah, it's one of the reasons I think everyone should try some sort of meditation or some sort of yoga at some point, like some sort of a mindfulness exercise, even if it ends up not being the thing for you. At times it can kind of, like, I feel like it can kind of wake you up. It can kind of force you to realize, you know, what kind of noise is going on in your head at any given moment.
One meditative thought that you introduced to me that I'd never heard before, but you brought it up on the podcast one time, was just sitting down and coming back to the thought repeatedly, I wonder what my next thought is going to be.
Yeah.
Since you mentioned this, I've tried it, and it's a really interesting experience.
Cool. Yeah, that one, I believe that was an Eckhart Tolle idea. I mean, it's kind of a mantra in many respects, but a very simplified, boiled-down mantra that's just kind of like sticking a little roadblock into your constant highway of mental traffic.
Yeah, it has a way of calling attention to the fact that your mind is sort of this deep chasm from which things emerge without really you having any control over it. And usually this just happens to you and you don't notice it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like, yeah, I'm just thinking. But thinking about thinking makes thinking become very mysterious.
Yeah, it does. It forces you to reflect on your own cognitive processes and try and figure out what's going on there. Now, meditation, obviously, as everyone can tell from the discussion thus far, it touches on cognition. It touches on various aspects of human health.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, there have been a number of studies over the years that have looked into its, you know, its possible effectiveness on mental or physical health, looking at exactly what it does, like what is the meditative state look like in the brain.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, there have been some key findings that have certainly made the rounds over the years and sort of forced people to look more closely at meditation. One study that made a lot of headlines was a 2012 study from the Institute for Natural Medicine and Prevention that found that African Americans with heart disease who practiced transcendental meditation were 48% less likely to experience a heart attack or stroke.
Yeah, so I want to come back to that claim in a minute. I've got complex feelings about the medical research on meditation, mm-hmm. which we were talking about this off mic before we came on, but I would not put them in exactly the same bucket with, but sort of adjacent to the bucket of prayer studies.
Okay.
Meaning that both, I guess both fit into a larger bucket in this world of buckets, the Russian dolls of buckets that we live in. So when it comes to these types of research, I think some skeptics would look at prayer studies and meditation studies and say, why would you waste your time? You know, what can be gained from studying this? You can already be pretty sure it's a bunch of magical BS, and it's going to be conducted by believers who are going to cut corners in their methodology to make their worldview look good. And so there's part of that I agree with and part I don't agree with. I don't at all agree with the idea of why would you waste your time, because I don't know. I think it makes more sense to be the kind of skeptic that says, well, bring it on. Let's see.
Yeah.
If it gets good results and if other people can replicate those results, especially hostile people who are, you know, not part of this worldview, can replicate the same results, I think that's something we want to know about.
Yeah. And certainly if it's something that can be scientifically studied.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, on the other hand, I do think there's some merit to the idea that things like prayer studies and meditation studies require some careful scrutiny before we accept their results, because there are some people who are convinced of the results before they start looking for them. Now, that's definitely not true of all meditation researchers, I think.
Right. Yeah. I mean, for starters, with prayer, there it seems like that's more likely a problem, because there's not really much in the way of secular prayer out there.
Right.
I feel like for the most part, if you are praying to a deity or a group of deities, you have some level of belief, or you're taking on some level of belief in those deities.
Though I think you could come up with secular explanations for the success of prayer.
Like, certainly, if
you had prayer studies that worked, I think that wouldn't necessarily prove any kind of magical thing. Mm-hmm. It would just say, well, prayer has some kind of benefits, and you could explain that in terms of psychology, of group social dynamics, all kinds of things.
Yeah. But again, to your point, there are plenty of models of meditation that don't involve belief in a deity or belief in some sort of particular model of bodily energy or, some other kind of like new age mechanism.
Yeah, absolutely. And in a minute, we're actually going to air an interview Robert did with a local meditation researcher. What is this researcher's name, Robert?
This is Dr. Jennifer Mascaro, and she's an assistant professor of family and preventive medicine at Emory University here in Atlanta.
And she investigates meditation from a secular scientific standpoint.
Yes.
So that can absolutely be done. But coming back to these medical effects that people claim are demonstrated by meditation, I don't want to rule them out, and I think research on this is valid, and I think we should pay attention to it, but I think it does deserve scrutiny, because coming back to that one result you mentioned about heart disease and transcendental meditation, I found an American Heart Association scientific statement from 2017. It was actually just released this year. So first, a general comment they make, quote, "Further research on meditation and cardiovascular risk is warranted. Such studies, to the degree possible, should utilize randomized study design, be adequately powered to meet primary study outcome, strive to achieve low dropout rates, include long-term follow-up, and be performed by those without inherent bias in the outcome." So generally, they're saying that it does appear that there could be some good places to go with meditation and cardiovascular health research, but a lot of the studies that exist today have some of these problems with methodology that make them less robust or convincing than they could be. And referring to that 2012 study about cardiovascular health and transcendental meditation, they say, quote, "The study, though, was conducted in two phases after a one-year hiatus, with 58 patients not participating in phase two of the study, and some concerns about analysis of the data have been raised." So it sounds like that when you get this big claim like this, wow, you get these amazing results from transcendental meditation, they're saying, okay, we might want to be cautious about overinterpreting these study results because the methodology was less than perfect.
Right. And as consumers, we have to be careful about sort of having the red wine or chocolate effect with studies like this, where
right. We
like red wine or chocolate.
Yeah.
And then when a headline comes up that supports the thing we like, we just kind of we kind of check it off in our mind and move on.
Well, yeah, and to be cautious about those studies is not to say that red wine and chocolate do not have their wonderful benefits in terms of flavor and enjoyment.
Right.
And the same thing could probably be said about meditation. I would say even if you don't find that meditation has any measurable cardiovascular benefits or anything like that, benefits on long-term chronic health conditions or pain reduction or anything like that, it still obviously has this role in people's lives that, people get immense pleasure from it. They find that it changes the way they view the world. It does do something, even if it doesn't do everything people claim it does.
Right.
So ultimately, I think meditation research is a highly valid field of study, and I wouldn't be surprised if it turned up really effective results, but I also think it's a field where I would just tend to treat claimed results with special caution and scrutiny. Not a fault of meditation itself, nothing wrong with the practice of meditation, but I always try to be cautious whenever I see a new claim about meditation results.
So I recently partnered with videographer and audio producer Tyler Klang here at the office on a couple of interviews for a meditation video project. Now, company priorities changed and that kind of left the project in limbo, but I didn't want to lose the great content we'd already achieved. So we're going to feature some interview content with Emory University meditation researcher Dr. Jennifer Mascaro and with the physician Vedic meditation teacher Jill Wiener. This will also enable us to finish the video in some form, and you can look for that in the near future. Obviously, we'll put that up on stufftoblowyourmind.com and also on the social media platforms. So let's go ahead and introduce Dr. Jennifer Jennifer Mosquero here. Again, she's assistant professor of family and preventive medicine at Emory University here in Atlanta, where she's also worked with the Department of Anthropology. She specializes in the variation in and plasticity of human social cognition and the biology of interconnectedness. She recently came into the studio and chatted with us about the current state of meditation research and her own fascinating contributions to the study of not only mindfulness meditation, but compassion meditation.
Robert, I want to say I enjoyed this interview, and I thought Dr. Mosquero was great.
Awesome. Well, let's take a quick break, and when we come back, we will just jump right into the interview questions with Dr. Mosquero. Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. A-S-T-E-P-R-O allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use this directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
All right, we're back.
Hi, Dr. Mosquero. Thank you for joining us here. So my first question is just broadly speaking, what's the current focus of your research at Emory?
Yeah, a lot of the research that we're doing is on different meditation practices that we think have the most evidence for impacting people's well-being. And so in particular, we're looking at two different types of meditation. So one is called mindfulness meditation, and that's actually what most people think of when they hear about meditation. But we're also doing a lot of research on a compassion meditation practice that comes from a very old Tibetan Buddhist tradition, and is thought to cultivate feelings of connectedness with others, feelings of compassion and empathy for others. And it turns out that that's really good for our well-being.
So what's your personal history with meditation?
I started dabbling primarily with mindfulness meditation back when I was in high school. I was a really serious athlete, and it turns out that mindfulness meditation is really helpful for mitigating stress and anxiety, especially when you're performing. And so I used to do mindfulness practices when I was anxious about a big game or, you know, in the aftermath, if I felt like I didn't perform very well, it was really helpful for not ruminating. And so I dabbled here and there. But then it took a new direction when I started graduate school and I was interested in the plasticity of the brain. And here, you know, we have these practices that have been cultivated and perfected over, you know, many, many hundreds of years that we think impact the brain and systems in the brain that I was really interested in studying. And so I really turned from being a dabbling practitioner to really more of an, at least hopefully, objective scientist.
So how do you go about conducting hard scientific research on something like meditation?
We try to do research on meditation similar to the way you would do research on, for example, a drug or any intervention. So the gold standard is with a randomized clinical trial where you randomize some people to the meditation practice that you're interested in, and you have another group that's randomized to some control group. The ideal study design has you're comparing meditation to an active control group. And the reason for that is because there are a lot of things about an intervention that could be helpful, could change people, that aren't due to the meditation practice itself. You know, if it's a group practice, it may just be meeting with a group of people that you think are like-minded. Maybe meeting with a teacher, like a meditation teacher, is really helpful because you have someone to, you know, a role model. There could be non-specific things that are kind of doing the work. So you really want to try to control for those types of things. So one of the big ways that meditation is studied is with that sort of design. Another thing, though, that people do is they point out that that misses a lot of the cultural and contextual factors that often accompany meditation. So some people, and I think this is really important research too, are doing research where they're really doing more qualitative research to try to dig in and understand what meditation means to people when they practice it. What are the sort of contextual factors, the cultural factors that might be at play.
So you're talking about stripping away some of the ritualized cultural aspects to understand what's actually taking place in the body and mind. But isn't the counter argument that you can't separate these two aspects of meditative practice?
Exactly. And that's an issue that accompanies a lot of different scientific domains. You know, when you try to take something and put it in a laboratory setting to study it, you necessarily strip it of extraneous features that might be really important. And so that is a debate that happens in a lot of domains of science, but it's particularly important with meditation because there are these sort of cultural embedded factors that are likely very, very important and maybe the most important. So you are often, the researchers who study meditation are often sort of straddling this difficult question of trying to empirically study a practice in the best way they can, but all the while not removing and reducing it to something that is less than what it really is.
Now, in at least one of your studies, you even go so far as to avoid calling it meditation, right?
So, exactly. One of the challenges when you do meditation research is you don't want to bias people at the outset. You don't want to bring people in and sort of enhance the placebo effect, essentially. And so with a lot of our research, we really try to reduce some of the terms that we use that might convey a bias to our participants. And then the other thing is meditation, even though we talk about it here as being secularized and sort of stripped of its religious connotations, it's really impossible to do that. And so there are a lot of populations for whom that term, you know, it comes with some baggage or some connotations that may dissuade them, people from practicing or change the way they sort of interpret it or accept it. And so we try to minimize that the bias in our participants as much as we can. And so one of the ways we do that is to sometimes we don't even call it meditation.
Now, on the other end of the spectrum, Emory benefits from a partnership with Tibetan monks. How do you incorporate traditional meditation practitioners into the research?
Yeah, that's crucial. And that's one of the really exciting things about this research is this sort of partnership between scholars of a lot of different areas that are really coming together to try to understand a rich tradition in the richest way that they can. And so we have a, sort of a constant dialogue with those contemplative practitioners to try to understand the historical tradition, the textual tradition, and the monastic tradition. You know, those are three different things that have a real bearing on what we're studying. And it's impossible for scientists and scholars to have expertise in all those domains. And so it's really kind of a fun part of what we do is a dialogue with the Tibetan practitioners that we get to work with.
Whether dealing with a traditional Eastern model or a modern Western model, I think there's a tendency to see meditation as an exercise in shutting out the world. But as you already said, empathy plays an important role in many meditation traditions as well. Can you tell us about the Tibetan practice of Lojong?
Right. Yeah. So we look at a compassion meditation practice that emerges from the Lojong or mind training tradition. And that is a tradition that places a heavy emphasis on compassion. I mean, that is one of the ultimate goals is to be a being of compassion. And so these are practices that are thought to help us feel compassion, not only to the people around us that we often feel compassion for, but to others that we don't know and to people that we often have difficult challenges with. And so that's not one of the preconceived notions that we often have about meditation. Often when the word meditation comes up, it's about focus and attention, and often it becomes a tool of achievement. But this is a tradition where cultivating compassion for others was of the utmost importance. And within that monastic tradition, the practices were really done quite often to benefit others, not to benefit oneself, not to reduce stress or anxiety in oneself, but to benefit others.
What have you learned from your research thus far? Can meditation actually rewire our neural circuitry for empathic behavior?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's taking our research and coupling it with the incredible research that's coming out of other universities, I think it's safe to say that these practices, compassion meditation practices, loving kindness meditation practices, and even mindfulness. There's evidence that mindfulness impacts our social connections with others. This research really suggests that that we can augment the systems in our brain that help us connect with others, that help us read others' emotions. And then when you do that, it's very clear that there are huge health benefits. So one of the emerging lines that is connecting a lot of domains of health research is the incredible importance of our social relationships. Our social relationships impact the way our immune system functions, the way our stress system functions. And so as soon as you are able to bolster a feeling of connectedness, a feeling of sort of interdependency with others, you really do change the way you respond to the world around you, and you it becomes less threatening. It changes our body and our brain.
You also used fMRI in this study. Were you able to observe the effects of meditation in a subject's neural activity?
We did. So there are two different ways that you can use functional MRI to study meditation. So you could have people actually meditate in the fMRI scanner and see what their brain is doing while they meditate. But we did a slightly different thing. We had people practice meditation for several weeks, and then we wanted to see how that changed the way their brain functioned when they did certain important cognitive tasks. And we found that when people practice compassion meditation, they actually got more accurate when they read other people's facial expressions. So what we did was we showed them photographs of the eye region of people's faces, and we had them judge what they thought the person was thinking or feeling. And after the meditation training, they actually got more accurate. Their scores went up. And then the activity in the systems in the brain that are important for doing that, for reading other people's facial expressions, the activity in those regions actually increased as well.
So do you think meditation in the form of cognitive-based compassion training can be used to boost empathy in, say, an actual psychopath?
Yeah, it's such an interesting question, and it's one we immediately thought about when we found the results of our first study where we were seeing this effect on people's ability to read facial expressions. You immediately think of populations of people that may benefit, so children or clinical populations that really seem to struggle with these types of social interactions and social skills. We haven't done any studies with clinical populations in that way, so it's definitely too early to say. The other thing that I think is a really interesting and important direction for meditation research to go is really to try to understand whether there are differences in how amenable different people are to actually practicing. And what I mean is there's a real likelihood that there's a bit of a catch-22 where the people who might benefit most from something like cognitively based compassion training may actually really struggle to do it, or it may not resonate with them. They may not understand it. And so I think that's particularly important when we turn our attention to clinical populations. It may be that the populations that would really benefit the most or could really stand to benefit from something like compassion meditation or mindfulness meditation, they actually may have a real difficulty with doing it.
So some brains are going to be a little more susceptible to meditation than others.
Well, that's the hypothesis. There is a little bit of evidence now. We have one study where we found that people's brain activity that related to empathy actually predicted how much they would engage with the training. In other words, people who had a brain that seemed to be more empathic at the outset actually practiced more. And that does suggest to us that there may be some populations of people that take to meditation more, that may find it easier or it may resonate with them. And conversely, there may be populations of people for whom it's really a struggle. They may not understand it or may not resonate with them as much. Exactly.
So what does cognitive-based compassion training look like, and what does it feel like?
Yeah, that's a great question. So it's quite different, actually, than the mindfulness meditation practices that are often talked about in popular media. But it actually does start with a little bit of mindfulness practices. So the first segment of CBCT actually is the goal is to entrain attention. And so it begins with some mindfulness to the body, mindfulness to the breath, and then mindfulness to sort of everything, all the thoughts and sensations that stream throughout our mind constantly. But pretty quickly, you know, the goal there is to just sort of cultivate this awareness so that we can move on to the compassion components. And what it does from there is it begins with an appreciation for our ability to be more compassionate, our ability to cultivate the positive mental skills that we have, and a compassion for ourselves as humans that these things are difficult. And then it moves from there to discussions of and deep contemplation of our interconnectedness with others. So you might think deeply about people in your life and how much we rely on them, even people that we don't think of very often as being very important to us. When we really get down to it, we rely on so many people in our lives for essentially everything. And then we move on to an awareness that all of those people that we're interconnected with, they are at base so similar to us. We are also similar in wanting well-being for ourselves and for our loved ones, and really wanting to be free of distress and suffering. And those recognitions are quite powerful. The recognition that we are so connected with one another and that we are at base so similar to one another. The thought is that from there emerges a natural compassion and empathy for those around us.
Broadly speaking, what sort of strides have been made in meditation research over the past 25 years?
Meditation research has come a long way. So when it started 25 years ago, it was not in the mainstream. It was really the pioneers of meditation research really had to do a lot of it kind of in the back room on the hush hush. It was not considered rigorous science or rigorous health, a rigorous subject of to study. Since then, those pioneers have really demonstrated, especially in the case of mindfulness meditation, how powerful some of these practices can be, for a lot of different domains, both for reducing suffering, so reducing depression and anxiety, but also for enhancing the positive things like resilience. And as soon as some of that research started to get out and started to be conducted really rigorously, it started to be taken more seriously. And so when it is taken more seriously, doors open up. So more research funding goes into, big studies with lots of people. And all of that has a snowballing effect because we're able to ask more nuanced and better questions. We move from just really clunky questions like, is meditation good for us, to, better questions like, what is it good for? And are there potentially negative effects? Could it be that there are some situations in which meditation is harmful? We start to get a better tool for really studying these things in a better way. So that's kind of how I see it as evolving over the last 25 years.
In the paper, The Neural Mediators of Kindness-Based Meditation, A Theoretical Model, you mentioned that two factors are necessary for empathic response, a shared affective experience and a cognitive understanding. How do these come together in empathy, and what happens if either component is missing?
The idea is out there from the amazing social cognitive neuroscientists that have moved this field forward, that there are these, that when you look at empathy as we define it, as scientists define it, it does seem to have a few different components. And so in particular, those do seem to be sort of a shared resonance, an ability to essentially try on someone else's emotions. But at the same time, there has to be some sort of cognitive awareness that those emotions are, you're feeling them because someone else is feeling them. They're not necessarily just your own emotions, but you are recognizing them in someone else. How that plays out is, I think, the million-dollar question, because those seem to be really dynamic processes. They're talked about as different systems in the brain that allow us to do those different things. And it's quite likely that those skills sort of interact where, sometimes you may very cognitively attend to someone and then the emotions follow, or quite often it's probably the reverse. So there's probably a very dynamic complex interplay going on to that probably differs in every experience. We think of the times we empathize with someone, it's not the same every time, and so I think there's a really dynamic process going on there. But one of the to your second question, one of the pieces of evidence that scientists look at to suggest that there are these different components is that it does appear that there are clinical cases in which one is missing but not the other. And so this is not cut and dry, but you mentioned psychopaths, and there is a large bit of agreement that psychopaths tend to really be missing more the affective sort of resonance component of empathy. They often do okay on the more cognitive aspects of empathy, and the deficits really seem to be in their ability to mirror someone's emotions, especially negative emotions. They really seem to not resonate with others' anxiety and fear and suffering the way we do. And then there are other clinical domains. Autism is often brought up, where there's a different picture of what's going on. There may be more of the sort of cognitive piece that is problematic there, and they may actually do quite well at taking on others' emotions, maybe even too well. So it's not a cut and dry sort of situation, but it does look like there are different clinical domains in which one or the other is more problematic, and that tells us that these are at least just slightly discrete systems that are not completely synonymous.
Now, when you explain it like that, I can't help but wonder how it all shakes out in my own head. Like how much of it is column A, how much of it is column B, and how does it come together?
Right. Yeah. And then there's a new movement of thought out there that there are some scholars that are arguing that we should push aside empathy altogether, because what really translates into compassionate behavior is not those things, but our morals and our ethical code and some of those types of things. And that's a whole other domain completely. But there is some dynamic interaction that occurs between those components that allow us to empathize, and then our deep-seated sort of ethical, moral, and cultural codes that help us translate that into action.
So tell me this, do you think the world would be a better place if everyone practiced meditation?
Most of the things that we do in meditation, so whether that's mindfulness or compassion meditation, I think the reason that they're so impactful is they're very different from the things that we generally get sucked into doing in our day-to-day life. And it's especially in our, fragmented, incredibly busy lifestyle here in the sort of modern West, we are often disconnected from that interdependency and notions of interdependency that are quite obvious when we're able to take some time and look each other in the eye. And so taking the time to reconnect with those sorts of feelings and thoughts, I think would be very powerful, and very powerful for everyone. There are a lot of different meditation practices out there. And so I think the way that this field is going, the next step for the field of meditation research is really to try to understand which practices benefit whom and for what. So that will better help us answer the question of, should everyone do mindfulness meditation? Should everyone do compassion meditation? Or is it that some people could benefit more from one or the other? We're all busy people, and we don't have time to do everything. But anything that can help us feel more connected and look at one another in the eye and notice our shared humanity, I think that would benefit all of us.
For your own part, what is the meditative state like, and what do you feel you gain from it personally?
Yeah. I grapple with a lot of this stuff, from the day to day. And so I notice that it casually impacts me all the time, Well, I shouldn't say all the time, maybe not as much as it should, but there are many times where, I'm in traffic and someone cuts me off and I behave differently than I might have if I wasn't thinking of these things quite often. But there's a deeper, richer personal experience that comes, for example, when I am lucky enough to go on a meditation retreat or have, longer periods of time in more contemplative states. That always strikes me as a very interesting phenomenon of this incredible emotional richness that sort of bubbles to the surface, in both positive and negative ways. Sadness and happiness are closer to the surface But even when the sadness is closer to the surface, it's often a feels like a really powerful, positive thing. And so those deep moments of extended contemplation really just feel like, to me, like an opening up of this emotional life that often is numbed when we're busy and not attending to it.
What are your thoughts on the implementation of mindfulness in grade school?
Yeah, so there's a big movement to implement, especially mindfulness in the K through 12 curriculum, and there is some good research indicating that it is helpful, especially with emotion regulation, social interactions for young children. And so I think that has a lot of potential. And then we are looking at the possibility of incorporating some compassion-focused practices in K through 12. And it's striking how quickly children pick up on it, even faster often than adults do. A lot of the examples and exercises that come with cognitively based compassion training, kids pick up on it right away. And so I think it has a real powerful potential for helping kids remain connected with one another and remain connected not with just with their close friends, but maybe with others that they may have trouble with, others that they may not see as one of them, all of a sudden become, you know, a shared human, you know, with the shared childhood experience that they're going through. And so I think there is a lot of potential.
Do you know if there are any cultures out there that introduce children to meditation at a really young age?
Monastic traditions are so rich and so different from one another, but there are a lot of monastic traditions where children go away quite young and begin a monastic lifestyle. I'm a little hesitant because there are a lot of monastic traditions that don't practice a lot of meditation. So there's a lot of diversity in terms of what goes on in different monastic traditions. But certainly there are a lot of traditions in which the training starts quite early.
All right. Well, once again, I want to thank Dr. Mascaro for sitting down and chatting with me about her meditation research and just meditation research in general.
I thought one thing that was really interesting was the sort of the two-factor empathy model she talked about. What are your thoughts about that, Robert? Does that ring true to you in your life, like the idea that there is a cognitive component to empathy and then the affective mirroring component of empathy?
Yeah. Like I say, it really made me tease apart my own experience with meditation, but also my own experience with you know, things like empathy, like, you know, just how much of it, how much of column A, how much of column B, how is this coming together in my mind state, and how might it be coming together differently or not at all in other mind states, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's so easy to fall into the trap to think that we all have essentially the same hardware and software firing up every time we're engaging with the world.
Do you ever think that if you happen to be a neurotypical person, that like you can catch yourself having failings of empathy and that you're sometimes failing in one column and sometimes failing in the other column?
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. Because I guess I'm paranoid enough that occasionally I'll think back on my day, and particularly I'll think about conversations, and I'll wonder, did I have enough empathy in that particular conversation?
Yeah.
Did I talk too much about my own stuff? Did I ask enough about someone else's stuff? You know, you can drive yourself nuts with those questions.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah, and so now we have a whole other way to dive into that paranoid self-criticism.
Exactly.
All right. Well, I think we should do a quick break. And then when we come back from that break, we can talk about your conversation with Dr. Jill Wiener.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Klass as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai. There's joy in every journey.
So in working on the meditation video, I also interviewed Jill Weiner, a physician specializing in Vedic meditation for wellness and stress management, and she is also based here in Atlanta. She came in and she had a lot to share about the particular strategies of Vedic meditation, mindfulness yoga, and the use of mantras. But probably most importantly for our discussion here, she had a lot to say about stress.
Mm-hmm. So she is an instructor of what she calls Vedic meditation, which from what I could tell is very similar to or maybe the same thing as transcendental meditation.
It seems to be very closely related fields of meditation. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It involves using mantras to achieve this state of transcendence.
Yeah, I think that sums it up. So we're not going to air the entire interview here with Jill, but I wanted to just air a portion of it because it sets us up for a nice discussion about one particular quality of both Vedic meditation and the general science of stress.
I think it's mandatory. I think that stress is probably the biggest epidemic we've ever faced. It underlies everything. It underlies immune dysfunction, digestive issues, pain regulation, all these medical issues that we see as physicians and as patients that we experience. And if we don't have a meditation practice to help us regulate the way our bodies process stress, you can't ever catch up to it. The stress keeps accumulating and making you sicker and sicker. So for me, as a healthcare provider, helping me be able to care for people, that having that, the meditation as that personal practice for me was hugely important, but also as a human being who has stress and stress-related symptoms and illness, it also helps with that quite a bit. So adaptation energy, we like to think of it like your bank account of patience, your ability to adapt. And what typically gives you adaptation energy is sleep, eating well, exercise, anything you find to be restorative, like working on cars or gardening or knitting or walking your dog. When life throws you a little curveball, it takes away a little bit of adaptation energy. And if you have enough adaptation energy, you can handle anything that comes at you. What happens is we only have a certain amount, typically, and as it starts to run out, your patient runs a little thin and you feel a little thready. And then one little thing happens, it doesn't seem like that big a deal, and you lose it and you snap and have a full stress fight or flight reaction. So Vedic meditation and lots of other forms of meditation give you rest as well.
So one of the key ideas that that Jill mentions here and references a lot is that of adaptation energy.
Mm-hmm.
This concept that you have a personal depletable energy reserve for dealing with stress, a reserve that can be replenished as well as diminished. And you see it referenced in meditation, and I think it's easy to simply dismiss something like that as just a meditation buzzword or something, but when I started looking into it, like what is adaptation energy? Does it exist outside of the terminology of a particular school of meditation? Mm-hmm. It really gets quite fascinating.
Okay.
So the term originates with Austrian endocrinologist Hans Selye, which I imagine a number of people may be familiar with that name, because he is a huge name in the science of stress, just the understanding of stress, the cultural use of the word stress today.
Well, I imagine that stress was just a concept that had always been around, but he pretty much introduced the modern medical concept of stress, right?
Yeah, it's hard to imagine that right now, to think back. You know, you think back on even ancient figures, you can imagine Odysseus saying, oh man, this is such a stressful voyage home. I'm just so stressed out. I can't wait to get home and just relax.
No, they talked about like wearisomeness and anguish, mm-hmm. but they didn't talk about stress.
It's true. So yeah, in 1935, he identified stress as a syndrome occurring in laboratory rats. And in 1938, he defined general adaptation syndrome, which is also known as GAS or GAS.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen some commentators say that that's you know, rather unfortunate that's what one can refer to it as. But he signaled this out as a three-stage biological response to stress. So the three stages are as follows. First, alarm. This occurs when you encounter stress, the also known as the alarm reaction stage, the AR stage, and it includes the arousal of your fight or flight response to a stressor, and all of your internal alarms are activated and you prepare to face danger or run away.
Mm-hmm.
And then he lays out the second stage, the resistance stage, the stage of resistance, or SR. And in this, the human response to danger is in full swing. So your pupils dilate, your heart rate and respiration go up, and your muscles contract. And then where you really get into the general adaptation syndrome here is a third stage of exhaustion. This is when your body stays in an excited state for a prolonged period. It enters the final state of the gas, the state of exhaustion, or SE. And this occurs when in response to a stressor that has gone on too long. In this state of hyperarousal, the body's immune system begins to wear down, and as a result, the person will become more susceptible to infections and other illnesses as the body's defenses have been spent on dealing with the stressor.
Hmm. So one interesting way I read to think about stress is that you think about a disease or an injury or something like that causing symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are symptoms that result from some type of damage to or pressure upon the body.
Yeah.
But there are also these general symptoms that seem to happen basically no matter what you're doing to the body, as long as it's having some kind of cumulative negative effect.
Yeah.
So like whether you're tired and deprived of sleep or infected by – a disease, or you have gotten a bodily injury, or, you know, any number of things that could happen to you, they all seem to sort of lead to this similar cluster of symptoms. And so you could think one way to think about stress is the body's general response to negativity.
Yeah. And I mean, and I guess the other side of it too, to consider with stress, is that a lot of the basic evolved biological adaptations, you know, we evolved to deal with tigers essentially, mm-hmm. but not paper tigers so much. And that's one of the problems with the modern world, right? Is that we get so stressed out over things that are not actual immediate threats, mm-hmm. but they
never go away.
Yeah, they never go away. They're constantly coming at you. So you can definitely see the modern application of this this idea, this general adaptation syndrome, and the idea that you would have only so much like bodily and mental energy to deal with a barrage of stressors.
Yeah, and Selye, he did sort of have an idea that this was a modern problem in a way, right?
Yeah.
Like, so you could imagine maybe our ancestors living on a savanna somewhere would have a fight or flight response if like, a large leopard comes near them or something. Mm-hmm. You know, that's like an immediate stress point that you've got to deal with. But what if it's like you have put yourself into a state of being where you're almost never facing actual acute danger, but your entire life there's a leopard over there on the horizon?
Yeah.
And it never gets too close to you, but it also never goes away.
Yeah. It's always potentially in your email folder. It's always potentially in your mailbox.
Yeah.
Or on your doorstep. I mean, this is the paper tiger that we've grown accustomed to. Or haven't grown accustomed to, if you rather. So one of the interesting things about Selye's work is that the modern use of the word stress stems from his work. Mm-hmm. And interestingly enough, his findings that were rejected by physiologists until the 1970s. As Russell Viner put it in his paper, Putting Stress in Life, Hans Selye and the Making of Stress Theory, Selye used stress to describe an organism's adaptation response to the environment, quote, that is the state manifested by the gas. In this reconceptualization of stress, Selye believed himself to have discovered a universal truth regarding the relationships of organisms with their environment.
Hmm.
And he also pointed out that Selye had some pretty lofty ideas about his stress theory, that civilization was disordered on two vital levels. The, quote, diseases of civilization, such as cardiovascular diseases, these were caused by poor adaptation to modern industrial life. And on another level entirely, he saw that Western civilization bore the cracks of intense social instability. And stress theory, he argued, could save us from both of these.
Mm.
So he was not shy about championing stress theory.
Right.
Now, according to Viner, the U.S. military were among the first to really embrace his ideas on stress and operational efficiency in the post-war period.
And that somehow doesn't surprise me.
Yeah, they jumped right in there. It does fall in line with a lot of the recent topics we've covered related to Cold War research.
Yeah, like mid-century military research went into a lot of fringe territory, though I guess this is one that eventually became mainstream science.
Yeah, because on one hand, you want to know how your troops are going to behave in a stressful situation, but they also considered stress a useful weapon in potential psychological warfare based on his work and the work of others. In fact, Viner says, quote, the military's fascination with stress became such that by 1976, over one-third of prominent researchers in the stress area were based in U.S. military institutions.
Huh.
So it's no surprise then, I suppose, that one of the papers that I found on adaptation energy came from a 2009 issue of the FBI Law Enforcement Bulletin titled, alarmingly enough, On the Edge, Integrating Spirituality into Law Enforcement.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Did you read it? I mean, what kind of a read is this?
It was an interesting read. I just kept coming back and saying, wait, is this the real FBI Bolton? Is this something else? Does FBI stand for something other than Federal Bureau of Investigation? Because it's certainly interesting to see this article in an FBI publication after watching Mindhunters, which of course displays sort of the old school FBI.
Yeah, the Netflix series Mindhunter.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The old school FBI of the 60s and 70s, like entering into a new age that is open to psychological science.
Yeah.
And you can find that article. If anyone wants to read it for themselves, you can find that online. It's by Inez Tuck. But the concept of adaptation, energy, and stress, this was also embraced by transcendental meditation, to bring us back to meditation. And Selye himself became interested in the use of transcendental meditation as a stress management method after meeting with the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, the founder of the transcendental meditation movement in the 1970s, something that he discussed in later interviews.
Interesting.
Now, adaptation energy itself remains hypothetical, but many scientific studies surrounding meditation relate to the physiological effects of stress.
Yeah, I was thinking when listening to Dr. Wiener's interview that even if the adaptation energy theory is not if it's not literally correct in that you have some kind of fixed number of reserves that are depleted, mm-hmm. I think it could be very easily an analogy for something that is very true of the body, which is that there is such a thing as cumulative stress. You might not have a number that could be measured and that can be built up and stuff like that, but there are cumulative effects of stress, and it can behave sort of analogously to what she describes.
Yeah. I mean, you can think of it just like how many times would you need to be, say, reminded of something stressful in your life? How many times would you need to have someone jump out at you? Mm-hmm. And scare you before it would begin to wear you down, you know?
Yeah.
Just in the course of a day.
Right.
And therefore, it might be useful to find a room where nobody jumps out at you or nobody shouts something stressful at you.
Uh-huh.
And of course, for the most part, we don't even have to rely on someone else to jump out or someone else to yell something stressful, because we have this wonderful dialogue that's going on in our minds most of the time.
And the email leopard.
And the email leopard as well. But yeah, we have the default mode network in our mind constantly fretting over past and future. It's shutting off that voice. It's finding a room where that voice cannot reach us that has value.
Yeah.
And that's where meditation comes in.
Yeah. And I can certainly believe also that meditative practices could increase one's resistance to these stressors as they come at you, even after you've stopped practicing it for the moment.
Indeed. Now, for this episode, thanks as always to Alexander Williams for running the boards on this one. And thanks to Tyler Klang and Tari Harrison, who also came up with a couple of the questions that we used in the interview with Mascaro. Thanks, of course, to Dr. Jennifer Mascaro for talking with us, and to Dr. Jill Wiener. And by the way, if you want to check out Dr. Jill Wiener's work, you can head on over to jillwiener.com. That's W-E-N-E-R. And if you want to check out our work here at Stuff to Blow Your Mind, head on over to stufftoblowyourmind.com. That's where you'll find all the episodes, as well as links out to our various social media accounts.
And if you want to get in touch with us directly, as always, you can email us at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Are you still searching for your perfect place to call home? Well, now is the time to buy at Fisher Homes. If you're looking to move in before the end of 2024, May could be your last opportunity to start building your dream home and close before the year's end. If you're hoping to move in even sooner, Fisher Homes also has homes that are move-in ready and waiting for you, where you can start enjoying the benefits of homeownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with a new home advisor today at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home.
Xfinity has free premium networks for everyone this month, no matter what kind of entertainment you love. Addicted to true crime? Catch killer cases and more spine-tingling shows on A&E Crime Central. Crave adventure? Explore Asian action movies on Hayah. Searching for something extreme? Check out skating, snowboarding, and more on Fuel TV Plus, the global home of action sports. And find crowd-pleasing bops on iHeartRadio's Hit Nation playlist. There's new free shows and movies to love every week. Say free this week in your Xfinity voice remote.